Welcome to the Philip Wiley Show. Take a look behind the curtain of professional hacking and hear compelling discussions with guests from diverse backgrounds who share a common curiosity and passion for challenges and their job. And now, here's your host, offensive security professional, educator, mentor, and author, Philip Wiley.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Philip Wiley Show. Today I have Huxley Barbie joining me today. We were connected on LinkedIn and we met for the first time at B-Sides Albuquerque last September.
Right. That's right.
B-Sides Albuquerque. Then ran into each other again at Texas Cyber Summit. But yeah.
Yeah. Texas Cyber Summit. Yeah. Just a few months later.
Yeah. 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 So. Yeah. Because I remember you kind of, you had some issues with your flights getting into Albuquerque. And
yeah, I made it to B-Sides Albuquerque an hour after my talk was scheduled.
Did you get to do the talk, or they just, since you didn't make it, you didn't get to do it?
No, I didn't get to do it. And then the conference was like, people are leaving already. So there was no opportunity to give the talk anymore, unfortunately.
Yeah. It's kind of the downside. Once you get towards the later parts of conferences, I've experienced that a lot. You know, a lot of the local Texas conferences, you get to about 3 p.m. on the last day of the conference, people start taking off. So,
yeah, but I did have a chance to have drinks with Shubham, one of the organizers. So that was good, and I also met you. So that was the other positive.
It's good to meet you too.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, it's good. It's nice that I like the opportunities of the folks you get to meet at the conferences. That's one of my favorite parts, is getting to meet people that you're connected to either already, or just people you get to meet that you've never met before or not connected at all. So,
and in fact, one of the first things that one of the guys told me when I showed up was, hey, come meet Philip Wiley. And I'm like, are you kidding? He's here? What? You know? So it was good.
So yeah, before we get too much further into the conversation, I always get people to share their hacker origin story, kind of how you got started out in the industry and kind of what you're doing today.
Sure. So, you know, funny enough, the other day I was telling a colleague, friend of mine, where I went to high school, and his immediate response was, wait, you went to the school where they filmed Hackers, right? And I'm like, yeah, that's where I went to high school, right? So if you watch the movie, you know, Crash Override, Acid Burn, that movie was filmed in my high school.
Oh, that's cool. Here's
a tidbit. They did have students from my high school as extras in the movie, but none of those students who were extras were from the hacker crew. None. Yeah. I mean, this was mid 90s, right? So super early days. And I mean, like, there wasn't an official hacker crew. Like, we were just a bunch of kids who gravitated around the AP computer science program. And we also had interests in playing around. So that's what I mean by hacker crew. Just this really loose collection of kids who are interested in computers and also gaining access to things that might be interesting. And that is, I guess, like where it started, right? Me taking AP computer science class, you know, which at the time meant learning Pascal. This is, I think they transitioned to Java at some point, like, you know, a decade later or something like, but yeah, it was Pascal. Pascal programming was what I did at the time. And, you know, fast forward to college, I was, of course, working at the computer lab, the college computer lab. And, you know, I was able to hone my interests in both networking as well as just computers in general, computing in general, but also security as well. And at the time, which I'm sure people will be shocked now, I was making $4.60 an hour, doing my college work study program. And I found out that if I worked off campus, I could be making $12.50 an hour. And like immediately I went out and bought a motorcycle so I could commute to this other job of mine. And I was, my work was primarily around networking, which is great. It was a great learning experience. It was a small mom and pop value added reseller. And I had the president of the company really mentored me. Steve Klein, if you're out there, shout out to you. But he's from the old school where he worked with like PDP 11s from back in the day. Like this guy could like go all the way down to like soldering and go all the way up to application programming. And he taught me a lot about networking. And this is also the time when a lot of smaller businesses were coming online, right? They were getting their, because DSL, like digital subscriber line just came into a thing. It just became a thing that could be sold. Because before this, you were buying frame relay DLCs or fractional T1s. But DSL just became a thing. So a lot of these small businesses were coming online. And the smarter ones obviously started looking at, you know, security, protecting themselves. Because I was the guy at the company that was doing all the networking, it made sense for me to also start doing security from a defensive perspective, right? So this is my first time ever doing security from a defensive perspective. And my job was primarily to set up firewalls. And so I was able to take my networking knowledge and, you know, former playing around in offensive security and start doing defensive security, doing firewalls. Later in my career, I would start doing other things around, you know, assessments and deploying other types of solutions beyond just, you know, layer three, layer four firewalls, but like, you know, web security gateways, secure messaging solutions, and so on and so forth. But also during this time, I did a lot of programming as a full-time developer for different parts of my career. And so application security also became something that I worked with as well.
Very cool.
But for those in your audience who are new to cybersecurity, I don't know if I have a whole lot to offer in terms of advice, because when I came up, this was a time before there was a term CISO. This was a time before there was a term red team or blue team. Like that didn't really exist. Like security teams didn't exist. There were no such thing as a security program really. Like, and hacker wasn't considered a bad word at the time necessarily. Yeah, so
before the media. Yeah. Kind of change the meeting. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, I think the most well-known thing at the time might've been like Cliff Stahl's book, you know, Cuckoo's Egg or The Worm by Robert Morris, like things like that. But like, it wasn't a thing. And I guess coming full circle here, I think the movie Hackers kind of contributed to the myth and lore around like what it's like to be, a hacker, which, There's a lot there to laugh at in the movie, I'd say.
Yeah. Speaking of, I just recently watched a movie. I'm trying to think what movie was it that I saw. Oh, yeah, it was kind of crazy. It was that new movie, Argyle. And there was kind of one technical discrepancy in the movie that they had around hacking. They were saying that their target had a Metasploit firewall.
Right, of course. Yes, the Metasploit firewall.
CEO would probably get a laugh out of that if he hasn't heard that yet.
I'm sure he would absolutely laugh at that. I mean, yeah, it's not an oxymoron, but it's a ridiculous term, I would say, right? But if I could give any advice to anybody that's coming up, I'd say do spend a lot of time on your own trying to learn. So I spent a lot of time in my dorm room just playing around with things. You know, I built my own computer. I installed FreeBSD so I could learn Unix system administration and have control over the system. It's so much easier now these days, right? You can just spin mm-hmm. up a VM. Like you could totally learn the ins and outs of Unix, Linux in order to understand what it's like from a security perspective. And I think the other thing is like, don't be afraid to get your hands dirty. Like volunteer for the jobs that might seem like they're daunting or overwhelming, but if you believe that there's going to be a good learning experience out of it, just go ahead and volunteer for it, sign up for it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely something coming back from, you know, our beginnings, because I started out as a sysadmin, but I think sometimes people underestimate the power of learning how to build, you know, right. How to build servers or computers, you know, from, assembling the parts to installing OSs and different apps and services on there, as well as learning how to network and all that, because that was a huge help for me when I started out pen testing, because I had that sysadmin background. And honestly, you know, if you really don't understand the command line of those operating systems and networking, if you get a shell to a system, you're going to be doing a lot of Googling, trying to research what you can do.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to use, you know, what's the fancy term, like living off the land binaries, right? You need to know the binaries, right? And if you're in a time crunch and you're having to check the manual pages for every single command, it's not going to work, right? So you're just going to run out of time. So yeah, absolutely. Like having that experience and just knowing some of these commands off the top of your head really, really helps. And there are some things that only with practice that you can sort of leverage in order to intuit, like how are the different ways you can compose these commands. So, you know, in Linux, there's piping, there's redirection, there's different ways. Just knowing that command is good, but also knowing how they can be chained up to do something more powerful is also something that's really, really useful when you're introduced to a terminal and having to do something useful with that.
So how helpful was learning to code for you in your career?
Immensely, immensely. And for a number of reasons, like if you've written code, and it doesn't matter what the language is. So set aside, for example, like the functional programming languages, which rarely find its way into production environments, right? Nearly all of the languages that we use today that are in production are procedural languages or object-oriented languages where you have procedural code inside of your methods, right? Set aside declarative languages like SQL and all that, right? When you have a lot of experience writing code and understanding how to make the computer do something, right? And understand what goes through the mindset of the developers as they're trying to refactor code, make the code more modular, make the code more robust, and so on and so forth, you can intuit how an application should be working or is supposed to be working, or what are the things it might be doing in order for it to operate, right? You can intuit that, hey, you know, as it's starting up, it's probably reading a configuration file somewhere, or it might be trying to connect to a database or something like that, and so on and so forth. Or if it's like lazy loading a database connection, like these are different concepts that you learn as you're learning how to program, then that allow you to then help you when you're trying to reverse engineer what an application is doing. So that is immensely helpful in one respect. I'd say the other respect is, especially if you're doing network level programming, you end up learning the protocols really, really well, right? So, for example, I did a lot of programming around SMTP and the MIME format, right, which is how emails are encoded, which also includes like learning how quoted printable works, how Base64 works, and so on and so forth. That is something that's immensely helpful to you as somebody that's working in offensive security, because oftentimes you're having to reverse what reverse encodings or understand like what are the different payloads that might come because of the protocol that you're doing. Another example would be HTTP, right? Understanding how HTTP works, what are all the different error codes, even though they're not technically all errors, or let's just say HTTP codes that come back and forth, and how different types of payloads are loaded at different times through asynchronous requests and so on and so forth. By you programming that, you understand it in such a deep level that when you're trying to do reverse engineering on somebody else's application, you have a much easier time. You know what to expect. You know things that are seemingly strange because like that's not how that's supposed to work or something along those lines. It really, really helps you to be faster about understanding what an application does and then potentially finding vulnerabilities in that application. And also, programmers, like the third point here, programmers often take shortcuts, right? There's no programmer out there that has not disabled verification of SSL certificates, right? Every single developer has done that because what? I'm doing this in development. It's fine. I'm just trying to get it to work. When we go into production, we'll go ahead and fix that later, right? So every single developer has done this at some point. And so you, as somebody who's trying to do offensive security with a programming background, you're able to sort of like intuit, okay, where might they be doing things? Where might they have tried to take a shortcut that they shouldn't have? Or where may they have taken a shortcut that they had intended to close up or remove when they go into production, but they never did? This is how these things come up. And having that programming experience really helped me over time.
So what languages would you recommend for someone starting out these days?
Oh, I'm very language agnostic, right? I've written in over a dozen languages, and I mean, today, you know, probably the ones that I would go for if I wanted to write anything, it would be Go, simply because like it's very popular right now. But, you know, if I wanted to prototype something very fast, I'd probably write in Python or Java, simply because I don't know Go as well as I know the other two. The thing is, the programming language that you choose has a lot to do with the application itself. If you want to create something that's super, super fast, that's close to the operating system, and it's small, you know, I could still see somebody writing that in C, right? You know, obviously it's not memory safe, it's not type safe and all that stuff, but if you're doing something really small and it needs to be super fast and close to the operating system, C, or if you can stomach it, assembly. But a lot of it depends on what you're trying to do, what are the libraries that are available to help you go do that, and your own comfort level with that language, right? I once met this guy, he's a founder at a company, and he was writing software for like advertising, that sort of links together these different advertising networks. And he wrote it in C, and I said, why would you do something like that? He's like, this is the language that I know. And guess what? His company got bought by Yahoo for $85 million back in the day. So it's, you could argue all day about the different features of different languages being better or worse, benefits and drawbacks. At the end of the day, it's about what you're trying to do and how fast can you get there with that language, right? So one day I hope to be better at Go so that I can, you know, be able to prototype really quickly with Go. But for now, like if I want to prototype something really, really fast, it'd still be Java or Python.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the evolution of things out there, just like, you know, Perl, whenever I was first getting started out in security or even before security, everyone was using Perl for stuff. And then they got all these good libraries for Python, and then everyone started going to Python, and now you're seeing more Go usage. I mean, there's like the Black Hat Go book out there for people that are wanting to learn how to use it for pen testing or red teaming, but really interesting to see how it's evolved. And also interesting, going back to some of the comments you made about understanding how things work. I was watching a cross-site scripting tutorial by Nahumsek today, and just some of the things that really didn't click with me before, because a lot of cases, this is bad with, you know, especially bad for people like myself that are working in offensive security. Sometimes you don't stop to think, okay, if I'm going to do cross-site scripting, why don't I learn JavaScript? If I'm going to do SQL injection, why don't I learn SQL better? So then I can understand what these errors are going to cause and why some of these attacks you're running, you know, if your SQL injection vulnerability is not working or your cross-site scripting payload's not working, what are you doing wrong? So if you understand the underlying language, you're going to do a lot better.
You know, just case in point, I had a buddy of mine, he was taking his OSCP and he got tripped up by the SQL injection that he had to do. And I think it was OSCP. Anyway, he was trying to do some SQL injection and he got tripped up by it. And I think a lot of it, because I talked to him, you know, we talked about it afterwards. And based on our conversation, it was clear to me that he had a very superficial understanding of SQL and how joins worked. So I think that had to be part of it, right? Not having enough of a background in the thing that you're targeting as part of your project. And, you know, I'm not saying he would have passed if he was better at SQL, but, you know, it certainly would have helped. Couldn't have hurt.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely sounds like it tripped him up. But yeah, it's pretty interesting that you don't take a step back and think about that sometimes. Even like Jason Haddock's, you know, some of the recommendations he makes for people that are wanting to get into web app pen testing, you know, he recommends, you know, learning JavaScript, go on Codecademy, learning how to do JavaScript and, you know, HTML and some of these different languages before you get into it. And it makes a lot of sense too, because when I started learning web app pen testing, it was taking these courses that, you know, they're showing you how to do the different types of web attacks, but no one's going in and teaching you, you know, JavaScript or SQL injection. And so I see where there's so much that's missed there and so much opportunity to learn and improve your skills. And that was pretty evident today watching that cross-site scripting tutorial, just seeing how Naham Sek was going through the app. And if this didn't work, then, you know, you try this other way, you can try encoding, but then there's sometimes that, you know, it's just kind of really interesting to get into it and hear someone explain it from that level to really teach you, yeah, you need to learn more about this if you really want to be good at it.
You bring up a really good point, and this is a question or misgiving of mine. I hope it doesn't sound too much like a criticism of security boot camps, but I just wonder how effective their graduates are, given that like these boot camps tend to be short and there isn't a lot of time to learn the basics, because there's a lot of basics, right? Like if you're doing any sort of network, you know, pen testing, like there's a whole stack of network protocols that you need to learn to really understand what's going on. And if you're doing application pen testing, then there's desktop applications and there's like web applications. That's a whole other set of domain of knowledge. And I just don't understand how you can learn enough the basics in a boot camp in order to be effective. If all they're teaching is the superficial, like, hey, you look for these three things, and then, you know, there's this vulnerability that you could exploit. Like that is not a very versatile pen tester graduating out of that program. And it's just, I don't know how it's done. Like, you know, I've never gone through one of these, so I don't know. And so I don't want to criticize, but I just have my suspicions. I don't know how they're able to graduate folks so fast that are proficient.
For me, my experience with boot camps, I never took anything security related, but I know just from taking SANS courses, and SANS courses are 6 days, which is still, to cram in what you do in 6 days is a lot. You really have to go in, you know, there's not really a boot camp, but you have to go in afterwards and study. So if you're preparing for their exams, you have to study for, you know, go through the labs and study the manuals, because you're not going to walk away and be able to pass that exam right away. But my experience with boot camps is, back in the day, I got my MCSE 4.0, MCSE 2000, and my Cisco CCNA through boot camps. Fortunately, with the MCSE boot camps, I did have some knowledge in those areas, but with like the Cisco CCNA boot camp, for probably about a month after that, I could answer questions and get through some interviews that may have some Cisco related tasks in it. But after that month, I couldn't remember it, because it's just, they were preparing us for an exam, and I don't know how these boot camps work. If they're preparing people for the exams, because I know from like the boot camps for the MCSE and CCNA, we had practice tests that we drilled through going all these questions to pass it. But like you said, I don't know how someone could go through these boot camps and learn. That's really not a good way to do it. I mean, if you had some kind of experience in it and you're trying to get some certification, but yeah, I'm kind of with you on that, because
nothing replaces experience.
No,
nothing.
Yeah, that's even like the workshops. I teach workshops at conferences, and it's usually typically 2 hours, maybe 4 hours. And one of the things I tell students, I share a lot of resources, because I, you know, let students know, people attending the workshop, you're not going to learn enough in 2 hours or 4 hours to be productive. you'll get a little bit of exposure to it, and here's some things to learn further. But yeah, I agree with you on the boot camp stuff.
Yeah, experience helps. Like, for example, when I took my CISSP, for the 2 weeks prior, like just after work, I would do some test questions. And then I took the test and I passed. Like, there was, by this point, I think I got in like 2015. So by this point, I'd already been like working like 15, 20 years. So like, I was already very familiar with the materials. I just wanted to be familiarized with the test. And it was a walk in the park. Like, nothing replaces experience. No. And I hear about folks who are like struggling and trying really hard to study for the CISSP. And I have to wonder if it's like, maybe it's too early for you. I don't want to discourage anybody, but like, maybe it's a little bit too early if you're studying that hard for it, because with the experience, the knowledge comes on its own.
Yeah, because actually, when I got my OSC, my CSSP back in 2002, and I studied for 90 days, did self-study, reading one of the first CISSP study guides out there that wasn't created by ISC2, and went through that, studied that, used the CCCure.org website for prep, found there weren't as many study questions back then, went through that and passed it the first time around. But
yeah,
I think, and one of the things I think too, people speaking of the OSCP, I mean, the CISSP, I keep getting my certs confused here, but the CISSP, you know, people really need to understand that are going to attempt that. It's like they say, it's an inch deep and a mile wide, because it doesn't go in a lot of depth on everything. So even if you're just starting out, that's probably not a good cert to start with, to find something that's more technical, that's going to help them more with the jobs if they land a job.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say so. Yeah.
So you kind of have some automation in your background. So if you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit about some of the automation that you've
used. Yeah. So y'all can look at my LinkedIn, but for a time I worked at a large, very large, networking company that's also a security company. And my last major role there was leading a consulting practice around security automation. And primarily we automated one of two things, either security operations or incident response playbooks. And what's most interesting about that role was I was able to combine my software engineering background with my security background and bring it all together and led a team to do this. And, you know, we serviced, you know, dozens and dozens of customers in helping them to save time and save people, because, you know, our customers were doing a lot of manual tasks in managing their security stack or responding to incidents. And by creating that automation, we were able to save them from like the drudgery of correlating data, correlating logs with spreadsheets and so on and so forth, so that they could focus on higher cognitive functions, which is really what humans should be doing anyway, not being like human data entry. Yeah.
So what type of technologies were you using for your automation?
So at the time, the SOAR platforms that are very common today were not as popular and far more limited. Like these days, like with the second generation of SOARs, there's a lot more you can do, but this is like the really beginnings of security orchestration, automation, and response technologies. And so we actually just wrote code. We offered the customers like, hey, if you have a SOAR platform, we could do the automation on that platform for you. And only a handful of times did that ever happen. Almost always, they chose not to do that because they didn't want another platform to maintain. They just wanted us to go ahead and build the automation for them, because we provided support if it was just like a Linux box. So we would write our code to do the automation, whatever that might be, and we would just run it on a virtual machine for the customer. And we, for a variety of reasons, we actually wrote in Java for the customers.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting, the automation stuff. So since There's the big question always here lately is around AI. So what are your thoughts on using AI to automate things?
I just saw today, like, ChatGPT went crazy. Like, it was spitting back gibberish to folks who are prompting it. So I think AI has a very important role to play going forward. I would not run production environments on anything that uses AI dependencies right now. It's still somewhat unpredictable, I find. And given that you need this sort of determinism in the way that you are operating security, I would avoid it at this time. So let me put it this way. One of the principles that I learned from leading that consulting practice is the goal, your goal as a security engineer, somebody that's doing automation, should never be 100% automation. Rarely is that a good thing, right? Most of the time, you want to have automation of the really manual parts where humans are prone to error, right? The really tedious stuff where, you know, somebody who didn't have their cup of coffee that morning is going to screw up, right? You want to automate that as much as you can. But key decision points in that workflow should never be automated, or rarely should be automated. You're going to want to have human intervention here to review what the automation came up with in order to decide if the workflow should continue. Because when you do 100% automation, you run a very huge risk of automating something bad or automating an edge case that you had not anticipated, which can lead to actually more work in the end. It's led, for example, to a proliferation of firewall rules, like tens of thousands of firewall rules in your firewall that just showed up overnight. Why? Because your automation did not consider this particular edge case. And guess what? Now somebody has to manually go and clean up all those rules, right? Or an automatic phishing responder, for example, that unfortunately, when you didn't consider a particular edge case, started locking out different people in the company, right? Just like shutting down their Active Directory account, locking it out so they couldn't get in, you know. And unfortunately, one of the people that got locked out happened to be somebody in the C-suite. Like, these are the types of things that can go wrong with automation, right? These are real live production security automation systems. And rarely should you ever do 100% automation. Almost always, you're going to want some sort of gate where the human being comes in and makes a decision, should we move forward or not with further automation. And I fear what would happen if we were to introduce AI, because it's in my mind, to my mind, right? It's early 2024 here. In a year, I might think differently, but early 2024, I still find AI to be still unpredictable, and I worry about what it does. I mean, so many times I've given a prompt to you know, ChatGPT or Bard, and it hallucinates a response. And when I dig into it, it's like, okay, so where did you get this particular nugget of information? And then it responds next saying, sorry, I actually don't have that. So it, like, hallucination by AI is a real thing. And we do not want AI mucking things up by hallucinating what an incident response playbook should do. Like, absolutely not. You want to have certainty, and you know, human beings are still the best arbiters for courses of action and decisions.
And back to the automation thing too, you know, another thing people have taken consideration, if everything breaks, you still need to know how to do it manually. So if you depend too much on 100% automation, or you're not keeping some kind of documentation on how to do it manually, you may find yourself in a bit of a conundrum if you don't,
you know, you're not capable. This is another very important point, which is, it's actually, I have an upcoming talk at one of the B-sides, and in my abstract, and the talk is about security automation. And in the abstract, I said, how do you run a security engineering program where you don't end up with a pile of crap code that nobody wants to maintain? that nobody wants to touch with a 10-foot pole. Like, that happens a lot, right? Many, many organizations I've spoken to, they had this one person that wrote a bunch of code for automation. Like, maybe it was like an intern that did it over the summer. Like, oh, great, cool project for an intern. And then that person leaves and nobody else knows what to do with it. You know, either it's still working and nobody wants to touch it because they don't want to break it, or it stopped working and nobody can fix it. And then you end up in a worse situation than before when you were doing things manually, before you came to depend on that automation. So, yeah. I mean, and this is another principle that I think is very important, is you need to understand you are a programmer, right? Yes, you're working in the security field. You're part of the security domain, but you are a programmer, right? Or if you're on a team, you're part of a programming team. And that means you should adopt many of the best practices that developers have, that they live every single day, right? So regular automated builds, coding conventions, code reviews, writing to a spec, making sure this thing builds somewhere other than your own laptop, like just really basic things that any good software engineering team does, a security engineering team should do as well.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting to hear, you know, some of the things that kind of worry about AI, because I know a lot of people jumped in and not worried too much. I mean, you see some of the cases where people are putting proprietary or sensitive information into these different chat bots to get this information, and stuff's being exposed. I saw something this week, actually, that was kind of something to think about, where someone kind of assumed that some people are doing malicious things by inputting some of the code, or some of the things they're putting into these chatbots, into like ChatGPT, things mm-hmm. that would cause problems, or in so it could turn around and come back to affect someone else because this information is being inputted into the system.
Yeah, you know, at the last B-Size New York City, so I don't know if everybody knows, but I'm the organizer for B-Size New York City. Next conference is October 19th. Look out for that. But at the last B-Size New York City, Aditya Patel did a talk on the things that he was able to do. He was able to get ChatGPT to start doing things it's not supposed to, right? By giving prompts in a certain way. Like, I think at the time, ChatGPT was not supposed to load URLs from somewhere else, but he was able to get it to do that, right? By structuring the prompt in a certain way. So very, very interesting. There's still a lot of unknowns here with AI, both in the way that it can be used or misused, as well as the way it actually works. And it's definitely something that's not going away. I saw somebody on Mastodon comment recently that he was having more and more trouble finding dependencies that did not have AI in them. Like, it's just a thing that we're all going to have to deal with. It's a great capability, obviously. AI is a great capability, but it's also going to be a new source of risk that we all have to contend with. The thing is, though, you cannot avoid it. Like, risk avoidance is mm-hmm. not a thing anymore. So it's either risk acceptance or risk mitigation. Like, take your pick. Like, there's no risk transfer either. Nobody's going to sell you insurance for AI screwing up. So take your pick, you know, risk acceptance or risk mitigation.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting. Something I was thinking about the other day, when you think of all these potential things, I mean, you need to progress technology-wise, but when you think about 30 years ago, we didn't have all the issues that we do nowadays. And then just thinking about deep fakes, how easy it is to imitate someone's voice, create deep fakes, and some of these very complex attack styles are coming about. And you just think about every time we add more technology. I mean, I'm pro technology, but when you look at some of these things that it's possible, it's kind of scary.
It's old stuff too. Like, for example, like OT security was not something that we all worried about 30 years ago, right? I mean, mm-hmm. because OT networks are all air gapped, and you know, as they've started getting connected to the IT networks, they've come online, and now we have our critical infrastructure exposed to the adversary out in some foreign country doing, you know, like ransoming our oil or our pharmaceuticals or our water treatment plants. I mean, it's just, yeah, it's the industry has a lot of new challenges all the time, but some of these are actually old challenges that we didn't have to worry about before.
Yeah, it's very interesting, the OT space, how people have set up the connectivity and just made things insecure. But yeah, it's pretty amazing how you mentioned some of the old things are still around or being caused that really nothing all that new, just in kind of a different context.
Yeah, yeah. And the context being, like, every time I do something with OT, I feel like I'm with Marty McFly in the DeLorean going back 30 years, because that's how it feels. Like, on the IT side, there was a time we didn't have EDR on our laptops. We didn't have laptops, but we didn't have EDR on our towers. You know, even like antivirus was like a thing, like a new thing for us at a time. And like with OT, it just feels exactly like that. Like going back, you know, 3 decades to the Wild West of security.
So we're getting down towards the end of the episode. Is there anything you'd like to share before we close it up?
Sure. Yeah. Just if anybody wants to connect with me, or if you have any questions about anything I talked about here today, feel free to connect with me. I'm on LinkedIn. Just search for Huxley Barbie. I'm the only Huxley Barbie you're ever going to meet. I'm also on Twitter at Huxley_Barbie. And I'm also on the infosec.exchange Mastodon instance at Huxley. And as I mentioned before, BSize New York City is going to be October 19th, 2024. I hope you join our Slack workspace to get all the latest updates, or at least follow BSize New York City on social media.
Well, thanks. I appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to join me today. It's been an honor and a pleasure to get to learn more about you and your background.
Thank you very much for having me, Philip.
You're welcome. Thanks, everyone, and we'll see you on the next episode.
Thank you for listening to The Philip Wiley Show. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. In the meantime, to learn more about Philip, go to thehackermaker.com and connect with him on LinkedIn and Twitter at Philip Wiley. Until next time.